So thank you for coming again. So we'll get started with our regular meditation just for maybe 10, not too long today. So maybe 10, 15 minutes. So just take our sitting posture that we're most comfortable with. You can remind yourself about the 7 points in the lotus posture, or the 7 points in the posture. Or if not, just most important thing is just keep our back straight, and comfortably so. And we can concentrate on the breath, or a visualization if we're familiar with it. And let's consider for a few moments how fortunate we are. How much blessings we have in our lives. So we've been on this journey for countless lifetimes. And we have set the seeds for being here today. It's not an accident that we're here today, that we're interested in the spiritual path. So we have performed many, many virtuous actions. We have even met spiritual teachers who have set us on this path. So it's imperative that we use this life in the best way possible, and with a sense of urgency. We can't wait to be our best tomorrow, because there might not be one tomorrow. last time, I was here 2 weeks ago. I couldn't make it last time. I wanted to come last Monday, but I couldn't make it. But so you must have had a really, I'm sure Venerable, you know, must have much better experience with Venerable Children than I could. Let me put it this way: she must have made a much better presentation than I possibly would, because she's thought about this longer, number one, but it's not the length of time that's the most important thing here, but it's the quality. She has a much better understanding of this stuff than I do. So hopefully you got something out of it. Were there any questions from that, either from last, from Venerable Children's presentation or anything else? So this is the second to last class in our module, and we're a little behind. And so I was talking to Venerable Thupten Jhadren, before the last class, so we were talking about what I had covered and what's the sequence of things. She said, well, I don't want to talk about that because she didn't want to talk about it. Let's just leave it, she had good reasons. In any case, so now we're a little behind, but that's okay. But so what I'm hoping, what I was hoping to do today and next week is spend some time on the, you know, there's a, oh, by the way, before I go there, so I, last time, 2 weeks ago when we were here, I spoke about the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, and somebody who was here mentioned that you needed an empowerment. And I wasn't sure. I hadn't thought so, but I wasn't sure. But anyway, I checked, and you don't need an empowerment. So if you're interested, you can actually pick up the Guru Yoga from here, or it's in the prayer book, or you can get it from the fpmt.org site, and you can practice it anytime you like. It is really, it's desirable, I guess, to have a teaching from a qualified teacher like Geshe-la who's willing to teach it. But if you're not able to do that, then you know you can still perform it on your own. But in any case, in its place, I was going to do the essentially it's another Guru Yoga, but it's to Shakyamuni Buddha, which most of us are more familiar with than Lama Tsongkhapa. So I was hoping to do it today and next week because it's nice to do it twice so that you know, you kind of get a feel for how it goes. But since we're a little behind, I probably won't get to it today, but I'm gonna you know, to do it next. So I'm going to try to kind of cover most of the material today and then spend as much time as I can next Monday. And so that way you'll get a feel for, you know, what the practice is. Even if you don't do it, you know, it's very beneficial if you do, partly because, you know, someone asked me last time, I think, you know, why it is that, what is it about the Guru Yoga that's, you know, oh, so I had mentioned that, you know, there are two things that we have to do to kind of make progress on the path, right, which is purification and accumulation of merit. Because purification is like, you know, when you're planting seeds or planting crops or flowers, whatever. Purification is like removing all the stones from the soil and the junk, right? The bark and the stuff that's there that is not going to help you, right? So that's purification. So that clears out our minds of all the negative emotions and negativity that we have, that we've built up over the lifetimes. And the accumulation of merit is like the sun and the rain, right? So, and the fertilizer, so that our crops can actually, you know, seeds can grow and become flowers, right? Become something beautiful. So those are the two things. And so somebody asked, where is the purification in the Guru Yoga that we do? And I mentioned that there is a confession practice in the, as part of the Guru Yoga, but you know I mentioned that. But what I forgot to mention, and that's not the really important. I mean, that's not really what makes the big difference. If you've been in the karma module, if you've thought about karma, then they talk about the field of merit or the field of. So in other words, if you, for example, offer something to me, or not me, but anybody, an ordinary being, if you offer something to somebody, that's, you know, there is some virtue to it, right? Because you're practicing generosity. But if that person happens to be a Buddha, that same action has a much, much bigger impact. Right, on our own merit, right? So similarly, they say, you know, when the Buddha had was about to reach enlightenment, you know, the last stage, and he was sitting down and he was saying that, you know, I'm not going to get up from the seat until I have achieved enlightenment. And there was a girl, Sudhana, who gave him an offering of food and milk. And if you read the stories, you'll see it. So anyway, so just that act of generosity was the cause for her I think she achieved liberation, maybe not enlightenment, but she achieved liberation in the next lifetime, I think. So like that, you know, it's just an act of generosity. It's not a big deal, but it was given to a Buddha, right? So that's the, so like that, that's what's called a field of merit, right? So if the field of merit is of high, of great value, then, you know, the impact or the benefit that we get is also much greater, right? So the practice of Guru Yoga, where we do the confession and the offerings and so forth and so on, right? Because we're offering it to our gurus, who, as we will talk today, are equivalent to the Buddhas in our tradition, that, you know, then that is what really makes the difference, right? It's not just an ordinary offering. It's an offering of great, you know, it's like a transcendental offering almost, you know, and the confessional practice that we do. So all the whole practice is basically, that's why it has such amazing benefit, is, you know, whether we do the Shakyamuni Buddha Guru Yoga or we do the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga or any other Guru Yoga, that's why it has such great benefit, is because the field of merit is so vast. So, yeah, anyway, okay. So today then is kind of tantric day, because this is the part of this that we cover is, it really comes from tantra, you know, where, so we've talked about, you know, why we need a spiritual teacher. We've talked about what are the qualities so that we can judge who is a qualified teacher. We've talked about what are the qualities of a disciple, right, or a student, so that we are proper vessels. And we've talked about different kinds of teachers, how to relate to them to some extent. But the next thing that they talk about is, you know, how to view the teacher, right? And one of the things, well, the main thing they talk about is how the gurus are not only equivalent to the Buddhas, and there are reasons why, we'll go over that, but in some ways are even more important than the Buddhas. So they're of, you know, so in fact, sometimes in an altar you'll see like the gurus above and then the Buddhas and then the, you know, the stupa and the book and so forth and so on. So, and, you know, so let me bring up a section here that I was reading. So some time ago, I don't know, a few years ago, I was meditating on this, and I was, so I did a study, you know, I have like, I don't know, 6 or 7 texts that talk, you know, that I read or that deal with this. And so I kind of went through all the texts and I kind of summarized for myself because of the meditation points, you know, so you have to kind of, so I kind of made the summary of all the points so I can kind of easily just glance at it. And so that's what, if you see me looking at this, that's what that is. But so you know, one of the things is that if you read the scriptures, you'll see the Buddha himself, Shakyamuni Buddha, that is, the historical Buddha, but also other Buddhas like Maitreya Buddha, like Vajrapani, Manjushri, so forth and so on, they all said that, you know, when someone appeals to them, right, or makes prayers, makes offerings, or really sincerely wants help, that they will always be present, right? They will always appear. And the question is, how does that happen, right? Some, you know, kind of, so sometimes people ask, how does that happen? I mean, how can the Buddhas who are dead, right? I mean, you know, their body, you know, they're dead. How does that happen? Well, you know, they explain that, you know, the Buddhas are, you know, their physical body, of course. Well, first of all, the Buddhas are have omniscient minds, right? Which is not even, I can't even grasp what that means. I mean, you know, it's vast. And so they have many of these many qualities, and one of those qualities is that they can make, whenever someone needs help, they can emanate in whatever form is needed by that person, right? Right at that moment, whatever that person needs, you know, however they need to appear to that person to provide help, they can automatically appear. I mean, that's one of the qualities of becoming a Buddha. And, you know, the different levels of bodhisattvas, you can do, you know, so the first level, I think it's 1,000 emanations. Second level is 1,000 times 1,000, a million emanations, so forth and so on. So they can just appear in any form at any time. And so even, so when, you know, once they've passed away, you know, once their body has passed away, they're essentially, you know, their enlightened mind becomes what's called a dharmakaya, you know, the truth body, right? So the Buddhas have four bodies. I won't go into all that. So the truth body and that, you know, so they're, it's like energy basically, right? And so whenever they appear, it's from that energy that they appear, right? And so they can take a form, you know, Scott in front of me might be a Buddha. So the Buddhas can take a form in the form of Scott to appear in front of me to provide me help, right? And so this happens just from the power of our prayer, just from the power of our aspiration. I mean, power of our prayer, power of our, you know, asking for help. And this happens because they made this aspiration. They basically made this vow, right? When somebody wants help, I will appear. Right, that's why when we make prayers to Tara or Vajrasattva, for example, you know, Vajrasattva is the pure, you know, the deity or the Buddha to whom we make prayers for purification. Right? How does that work? Well, it's because of their aspiration. Vajrasattva made this aspiration that may, whenever someone does this prayer, I will do whatever I can to help them with their purification. Right? From that power of that aspiration, they're able to do this. Right, so then you can ask, how is that? So they say that in the scriptures, they say it's kind of like how, you know, a pharmacist or somebody who's a compounding pharmacist who makes their medicine, you know, makes the medicines. So they might die, they might pass away, but the medicines still have potency, right? So it's like that, right? You take that medicine, it will still help you. They may not be around, but the medicine has potency. It's kind of like that, where the Buddhas may not be around in their physical form that we can interact with, but their medicines, their aspirations have that potency. So that's how it kind of, the analogy that's given. And why am I going to all this? The reason is that the Buddha's made this vow, right? So one way we can, so when someone says, you know, when they say, we should think about the Guru as a Buddha, right? Why do they say that, right? It's because to change the way we think about our gurus, right? Because if we think about them as ordinary beings, what happens is our relationship is like our relationship with somebody in front of us, right? Our friends or our family. So we see them critically. You know, we're always examining them. We're always, you know, if they do something, we find it annoying or we're always wondering why they're doing it, some, you know, whatever. You know, there are so many, you know, we have these mental tendencies that we've built up, right? But if we think about them as a Buddha, as Lama Zopa says, it's all profit, no loss. You know, from our side, it doesn't matter whether the Guru really, we'll never know, but I mean, it doesn't matter whether the Guru is really the Buddha or not. And it's immaterial. Where it makes a difference is in our own mental continuum, right? If we are able to see somebody as pure, the profit is all in our own minds. It doesn't have any of, it doesn't have them, you know, it doesn't matter whether the other person is pure or not, right? And so it's all in our own, you know, we get the benefit of seeing, I mean, we get the benefit of their teachings. They get the benefit, you know, we accept, you know, it has much greater, you know, impact. It has much greater blessings. And so it has a much bigger, you know, it opens our hearts in a different way, you know, where what's we're open to them. So it's like that. That's why Lama Zopa says, all profit, no loss, you know. He says, you know, we see the Guru as a Buddha to get the blessings of the, you know, if we see the Guru as a Buddha, then we get the blessings of a Buddha. If we see the Guru as a Bodhisattva, we get the blessings of a Bodhisattva. If we see the Guru as an ordinary being, we get no blessing. You know, it's like that. And so one of the analytical ways they talk about this is that, so the Buddha's made a vow, right? Because their own, well, I mean, why did the, you know, before they became Buddhas, they were Bodhisattvas, and before that, they were, you know, other Arya beings and so forth and so on, right? So they progressed. So the only reason they became a Buddha is to basically be of benefit, right? That's the only reason, you know, when we make the prayer, may I be of benefit to all beings, may I become a Buddha to benefit all beings, right? I mean, that's the same prayer that they made, right? So once they're a Buddha, they're beyond conceptual thoughts, right? They don't, you know, it's not like thoughts like our minds and so forth and so on, right? It's basically they're spontaneously, you know, their compassion is so powerful, they're spontaneously arising, right? It's not like they have to think, oh, that person is suffering, I need to do something about it, what am I going to do, blah, 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 right? It's basically, you know, it's like that, right? It just is. You know, they see the suffering, compassion immediately arises. Their minds immediately know, because it's omniscient, exactly what to do. And it happens just like that. And then they appear, however they need to appear, right? So their only goal, really, only goal for existence, if you will, is to be of benefit. Right, so there are the Buddhas. They've said, "I'm going to appear whenever somebody needs help." And here's a student, let's say, right, who is practicing as best as he or she can, and who is making prayers, who's, you know, purifying his accumulation of merit, all this of this, and they're praying, you know, to get the blessings of the Buddhas, right? So they say that how can it not be that the Buddha will appear? Right? If a student sincerely makes that, you know, the offerings, the prayers, and is a proper vehicle, right, and wants to get the blessings of the Buddhas, and the Buddhas have made this vow, they have no choice but to appear. Right? And if they did appear, they have to appear to us in an ordinary form, right? We don't have the karma, we don't have the clear mind to be able to see the Buddhas in their energy form, right? And they're, you know, in the Sambhog, you know, those of you who know that, you know, the Sambhogakaya or the, you know, Dharmakaya, so forth and so on, right? We don't have the, you know, mental clarity to see, be able to see that. So they have to appear to us in front of, as an ordinary being, and who would that be? That would be our gurus, right? The one who leads us on the path, who is only, you know, who is doing it only out of compassion. And they're doing it because they see us suffering. They know how to help us. And they want to help us. They could be doing other things. You know, they don't have to be here. Geshe-la doesn't have to be here, you know. He could be, you know, he doesn't need to be here. He could be back in his monastery in India. And he'd have a perfectly fine life. He probably might be happier because he'd actually be able to do his practices and so forth and so on. He'd have a lot more time. He doesn't need to be here to teach us. But he's here because out of compassion, right? So like that, you know, if we're able to have that understanding, you know, we can see how it might be. You know, we can see how the Buddhas can appear to us in the form of our gurus. And, you know, so like that, you know. And another way they talk about it is, you know, if we didn't have the karma to be born at a time when the historical Buddha was in, you know, during his time, right? Or at least in this lifetime, we didn't have the karma to be born and with the Buddha in front of us, right? In his, you know, in obvious, clearly, clear, an obvious Buddha, right? Now, I don't know what that means, but a Buddha that everybody has, you know, agrees. Actually, I would say that His Holiness Dalai Lama is a Buddha, and so we are in a time where there is a Buddha. But, so you know, and the Buddhas have made, you know, they say that, for example, it says, anyway, I flogged that horse, I think. So that's one of the, you know, that's the kind of the analytical way to think about it, you know, that why the guru can be a Buddha. And, you know, it's, and as Lama Zopa says, it's all profit, no loss. You know, there's no downside to thinking like that. There's only upside from our side. Yes. Yes. Right. Right. Yes. No, no, not at all. So Buddha can appear in any form. So whatever form is going to be of most benefit. Right, a guru is one obvious. They can appear as our mother. It can appear as, they can even appear as inanimate objects, supposedly. No. Sure. Yes. They can appear. I mean, you know, we have experiences like that, right? We're in some situation, we're going through some pain, let's say, whatever. And, you know, I think, you know, people have experiences where something happens. Somebody comes in our lives for maybe a day or a week or whatever it is, and there's a transformation, and that person is gone, right? But we are changed, right? Like that. So, you know, they can appear and that's why we have to be open to these types of experiences, because we don't know, you know, it's when we are aware, when we only think about it like that, are we aware that something is happening, right? And Right, milk rice. I don't know, to be honest with you. But I mean, I think she had certainly the intention of being of benefit. You know, she saw a holy being, Maybe. Well, it in a way it's immaterial, right? I mean, the you know, I don't want to go too much and down that road because then we're kind of digressing. But basically, you know, the bottom line is that if we make an offering of pure with pure motivation, right, of nothing return to get, you know, from our no self, you know, no, nothing about the self involved there, right? So if we make an offering with pure motivation, then whatever virtuous, you know, whatever positive merit we gain, not only has to do with the intention, but it also has to do with the, you know, the field of, you know, who we are offering it to. So if we're offering it to our parents, it has higher benefit than if we offer it to, you know, my coworker. If I offer it to my, a Buddha, it has even more benefit than my parent. If I offer it to my guru, it has even more benefit than a Buddha. You know, so like that, right? And yeah. Well, it wasn't luck. It was certainly karma from our previous life to be born and that have that fortunate birth at the Buddha's time to be able to meet him. I mean, that it was. It's not. It's in no way is it blind luck. So, yeah. So you know. So that's. So and the reason that you know the to see the guru as a Buddha and these things are a little difficult and it comes from. Because this is it comes from Tantra, you know, and in our tradition, Tantra is integral part of it, and one of the reasons is that when we take tantric empowerments, right, you know, initiation, some of you probably have them, you know, it's essential, it's imperative actually, that we have to see. That guru, you know, the tantric master, right, who initiates us as a Buddha, and in any other sutra, you know, when we're hearing teachings about the sutra and so forth and so on, one doesn't have to necessarily, you know, do that, right? But if a master is initiating us into the mandala of the deity, then only because these are teachers who actually, you know, are in touch with that deity, with them, and, you know, so basically they are, you know, we have to think about the fact, you know, like they are essentially equivalent to the Buddhas, right? And they're letting us in, you know, to that realm, if you will, right? So so that's why in this tradition, seeing the guru as a Buddha, etc., is emphasized, right? In other traditions, you know, it may not be so much. In fact, in the Theravada traditions, they don't even have this concept, right? They don't, you know, the guru as a Buddha doesn't even appear. So, it says, you know, they appear in a way that ordinary people like me can deal with. Right, that's how the Buddhas would appear to me, right? And there is nothing else, you know. Every other guide that we have, you know, whether it's a teacher like in school, a teacher in college, or a boss who is a mentor, let's say, or anything, you know, those ordinary beings only guide us in the ordinary worldly life, right? Which is only help us in this lifetime, maybe to some extent, right? It's first of all, it's not. It's not true progress, right? I mean, it's, you know, we're making progress in the worldly way, concerns, right? The true path is the spiritual path, which doesn't end at the, you know, with this life, right? And so who can be of benefit? It's can only the Buddhas who transcend, you know, this, who've overcome the cyclic rebirth, right? And so that path can only be led by gurus, essentially, who see that, right? Who can guide us through the cycle? So the spiritual path is the most important. Most important journey, I guess, you know, that we'll ever take, right? And so those guides, that's why those guides are, we consider those guides to be emanations of the Buddhas. So it said the reason to develop recognition of your teacher as a Buddha is so you will not start thinking about his or her faults. And it says, you know, because it's so easy, you know, have you noticed our minds are automatically more disposed to thinking about faults than thinking about somebody's good qualities, you know? I mean, we tend to much more think about somebody's faults than think about somebody's good qualities. So that's why, you know, they say, you know, it's a way of overcoming criticism, you know, always thinking about our teachers critically. And that's not to say that we shouldn't examine what they say. You know, I think that always has to be there. But when we get to a certain point, we have seen enough of that person. You know, we have seen enough of his teachings or her teachings, and we have some, you know, confidence that this person is truly qualified. At that point, we have to be able to kind of, you know, then see them as equivalent to the Buddhas. And that's when we can, you know, we get the blessings of the Buddhas from somebody who is just in front of us, you know. So, you know, there's a story about Asanga. I'm sure you've heard the story. Some of you have heard the story. So, Asanga was, I think, in the 2nd or 3rd century. Great Indian master, he and his brother Vasubandhu were, like, you know, wrote some of the seminal texts in our tradition. And so he had been practicing for, I think, 12 years in a cave. And he'd been, long story short, so he practiced for 12 years and he was ready to give up because he just, you know, he was trying to reach Maitreya, you know, the Maitreya Buddha, who's the next Buddha to come, right? So, nothing was happening. And so finally just gave up and he went, you know, got out of the cave and went down towards the town. And he saw this, you know, dog that was lying on the street, had all these maggots on it. It was getting ready to die. Anyway, so, you know, in his infinite, so he was looking at this dog, and I'll make the story short, but basically, in his compassion, trying to help the dog, he realized, you know, when he was about to help the dog changed to Maitreya. Maitreya was the dog, right? And so Asanga's first, I think his first comment was, it was one of sarcasm, right? He said something like, so now you appear. I mean, I've been up there in the cave for 12 years. You couldn't, you know, you couldn't show yourself, but now, you know, you appear, right? And I don't think Maitreya said anything, but Asanga was carrying, the interesting part is, Asanga was carrying Maitreya above on his shoulder, and he was running through the town, the village, saying, look, here's Maitreya. And so, the townspeople all looking at him, look at the strange, you know, like, they don't have the karma to see Maitreya. Asanga was at a level where he could communicate directly with Maitreya, right? And so, you know, the townspeople like us don't have that clarity, right? That mental, you know, that aren't at that level. So they're looking at this guy, you know, with his hands like this, saying, look, there's, you know, they're kind of laughing at Asanga, right? But there was one woman in that crowd who was who had some karma, who had made some progress, right? So she was able to see Maitreya's feet. You know, so he could see the feet, but not the rest of, you know.
And, you know, you kind of look, you kind of, you know, so this is kind of like, you know, they use this example as, you know, how, you know, we have to be able to, you know, we don't have the karma to see the you know, the Buddhas in their true form, but so we have to, you know, but the Buddhas do appear in front of us as the guru, and so we have to be able to see them as such, right? And so you kind of, so that's the example they use, right? And you kind of think about, yeah, you know, so you say, well, yeah, 2,000 years ago, they all made up these stories, you know, I don't know how real it really is, and so forth and so on. But, you know, it's interesting. I'll tell you a story that I heard, and I heard it from a couple of people who I respect greatly, and, you know, they're monks, and they've been practicing for many decades. And so, you know, there was a great master called Kirtisensei Rinpoche who died 6 years ago. So, and he was one of these, like, maybe one of the last few, you know, he grew up in Tibet, old Tibet, and he had done, you know, practiced in caves and so forth and so on. So he was like, you know, like a great yogi. Not many of those around anymore. But anyway, so he was, he was a great practitioner of Kala Chakra, right? So there's a Kala Chakra, that deity there is Kala Chakra. And so that was his practice, was Kala Chakra. And so Kala Chakra has, you know, a lot of hands, you know, all arms everywhere, you know. And so anyway, so he was giving this, doing this retreat on Kala Chakra, and there were a bunch of students he was doing this retreat with. And this is in the West, you know, it's not like story someplace from cave somewhere. And so it was interesting, these couple of people said that after the session had ended and he turned, he was leaving going out the door, right? They could see, these are a couple of people who, again, have that mental clarity, right? So they could see the hands. They could see the arms. They couldn't see the rest of their body, but they could see the arms. And they could see that he turned sideways to go out the door. Because his arms couldn't go through the door, right? It would hit the side of the door. And so there were, so now these are two Western monks in the last 10, 20 years, you know, who had this experience. And I've been in Kirtisensei Rinpoche's, you know, teachings, and they're profound. And so I didn't have that experience. I don't have that level of, I haven't made that kind of progress, right? But, you know, this is what I mean is, you know, it's not these kind of things, you know, it's hard to understand and hard to believe. But, you know, I know these people and I know they wouldn't make it up, you know? So it's like that, you know, it really does happen. So anyway, I had a lot more, you know, the Asanga story became a lot more real for me after I heard about Kirtisensei Rinpoche. So the other thing, Lama Zopa is always good with these analogies. He says that reality is like a play. You know, he talks about how reality, you know, about emptiness and reality is like, he talks about the television, you know, how it's like frames just going by. You know, we just put all these, interpretations on the frames, right? On things that happen, right? We make up all these stories and, you know, but it's really just a movie. Just 30 frames per second, just going by. We just happen to see them as something moving in a movie, right? So he says that reality is like a play. So the guru is a character in the play. The Buddha is the actor with human clothes. So it's like that, you know. So we see the actor. What we see is really the actor with the costume on and so forth and so on. What we don't realize is that there's a person inside who is not the actor, you know, who is not that character. That's like that, he says, that's how the Buddha appears, you know, in our reality, in our play. And then the other ways to think about it, you know, for example, when we have you know, if we're thinking about the our teacher and we're having negative thoughts about it, you know, about him, we can think about how, you know, it's a product of our mind, right? It's a product of the negative tendencies that we've created over lifetimes. So it's hard for us to see the person for who he really is. You know, we put all these things around that person, right? So we have to be kind of aware of how our mind also is working. It's not like, see, we think that the person is solid, right? We think that the person is as he appears. We don't realize that the person as he appears is a product of our own mind, right? All the things that are created in our minds, right? It's a product of our own karma, really. So if we can remove the karma, we will see the person in a different way. So, she says that, you know, we tend to She says that, you know, when you properly rely on a spiritual teacher, your virtues will increase and your non-virtues will gradually diminish. You know, this is what I was thinking about, you know, and I sent somebody, you know, then Susan, I was talking to Susan, and she said that Venerable Thupten Shodron said this last time. And, you know, that I didn't know that she calls it the 911 call. Is that what she said? 911 practice. I'd never heard that before, but that's a good one. Yeah, but you know, it's so when we have this, when we try to make a connection, right, with a teacher, you know, I mean, you know, with His Holiness, for example, you know, we read lots of his books, we go to his teachings, we see his videos, and so when we're thinking about when we're having a problem, or we're having, problems, you know, it's good to always think, you know, what would he do? You know? I mean, I'm having this problem with my coworker or with my family or whoever, right? And that's always an interesting check to just ask, you know, what would he do? And usually it's, you know, when we give it some space, it's interesting, the answers that we get, a lot of times we wouldn't come up with those answers, you know, if we didn't ask that question. And so that's one of the ways that, you know, why it says, for example, you know, I was just thinking about this because it says, you know, your virtues will increase, your non-virtues will gradually diminish, right? Because when you're cultivating that connection, you automatically stop doing negative things, you know, because your mind automatically turns towards positive, right? It's always thinking about virtue. And when we're having trouble, then we think about it like, okay, what would my teacher do? Right? I mean, you know, so does that make sense? I mean, when we're in this relationship, we automatically always are trying to be virtuous anyway. But there, in those occasions where we're having, you know, non-virtuous thoughts or we're struggling with some issue, it's always interesting to ask, you know, what would my guru do? Because then it kind of helps us, you know. And we think, and then we think about, you know, what is, you know, what he said in a certain situation. You know, all those things come up, right? You know, we think, oh, yeah, he said that in so-and-so's, you know, or I read, you know, that,
you know, when somebody asked this question, he said this, you know, that kind of thing, right? So there's interesting things come up. So that's why, you know, they say the Guru Yoga practice is such an amazing practice. It's because it's not that the practice itself isn't the what makes a difference. What makes a difference is the transformation that happens within us. It enables this transformation that otherwise may not happen. And our minds just become more receptive. That's, you know, because we have closed minds for the most part. So our minds become more receptive. As my teacher says, you know, your heart becomes soft or moist, he says. Yeah. You know, it's like soil, you know, moist soil like that. This is all the small and great blessings. I'm sorry. All small and great blessings come from the Guru. Yeah, so that's essentially the summary of seeing the Guru as a Buddha, and it's a profound practice, and it definitely, if we're able to cultivate it, it definitely has great value, great benefit. And, you know, I was telling you those examples just because that's what I always heard, and, you know, those are the ones that made the most, the one about Kirtitensha Rinpoche, that was pretty amazing. You know, it's interesting, you know, you always read these stories in the books, you know, and you always wonder, really? You know, I mean, it seems fantastical. You know, you read these things and it just seems absolutely fantastical, you know, because our minds are small. We have small minds. We can't see, you know, we can't see past our experience. We can't imagine past our experience. It just seems absolutely fantastical. And maybe, till recently, till maybe 100 years ago, we believed in this, you know, we were more open to these kinds of stories. You know, we were able to take them. We're much more cynical maybe now, maybe much more. I mean, it's good to be skeptical, but I think at some point skepticism becomes negativity, you know. But anyway, So that was, you know, so it just seems fantastical. So when I heard that story, that was, and I've heard other stories like that, not just about him, but other people, other, you know, masters. But that was the first one I heard, you know, that like totally blew my mind. You know, I was like, wow. And, you know, so that's one of the interesting things is that, you know, when you, the first session I was talking about, how, you know, somebody asked me how, because you can't tell with a lot of times the quality of a teacher, right? And I think one of the things I said was, well, you examine his students, right? You see what are the students like? Have they been around for 10, 20, 30 years? Have they made progress? Do they look like, you know, they're calmer people? They have peaceful minds? Are they virtuous? You know, do they have, you know, I mean, all those things, right? They should have made progress if they've been around him for a long time.
And so when I heard these two people, and they were independent, they weren't talking, you know, it's like separately, right? So I was talking to, you know, so they shared the same experience. I was like, holy smoke. These guys have made some progress. Even if they can see Kala Chakra, you know, it's pretty amazing. So yeah, so that brings, you know, that's the kind of stuff that brings faith, right? And then you say, oh, and their teachers are like Lama Zopa Rinpoche and Kutisensa Rinpoche. Wow. So they're not just any old teacher. You know, these guys are real. So I think we have to watch our minds. You know, we have to watch and see what we're thinking about our teachers. You know, when our teachers are giving teachings and our mind, you know, we're having negative thoughts about the teacher, for example, you know, maybe, I don't know, I mean, you know, oh, it's going too long, why is he talking about the same things over and over again, you know, I've heard this before. I mean, there's all this stuff that goes through our heads, right? You know, we have to kind of think about what is our mind doing, and we have to kind of, you know, go through these, you know, these teachings, you know, these sections of the Lam Rim and kind of see that, oh yeah, my perception of this teacher is not the teacher. It's my own mental images, right, that are going through, you know. So we have to think, you know, all those things, right? Then we have to think about the teacher as a guru, you know, their great kindness, you know. I mean, Lama Zopa, you know, I was talking about Lama Zopa Rinpoche, right? I mean, he doesn't need to travel around the world nonstop, going from point A to point B all the time and giving teachings. I mean, you know, he's doing it only out of just great compassion. That's the only reason. You know, he goes to bed at, well, he does, well, that's a different story. He doesn't go to bed, but you know, he ends his teachings at, you know, we're kind of dreary eyed and annoyed, maybe want to go to sleep at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, and he, you know, he stops and then he, you know, and then he comes back at 7 o'clock in the morning so he can be, you know, some of these retreats, you know, you go to bed at, I don't know, 12 o'clock, 12:30 if you're lucky, and then you have to get up at 5:30 maybe, 6 o'clock, I can't remember. This is for 2 weeks straight you have to do this. But anyway, and then, but you get used to it. After the first couple of days, you're just in this zone, you know. But anyway, so, but you know, and you do this guru yoga, you know, we do this guru yoga practice at, I don't know, 6 o'clock in the morning after, you know, before sunrise. And so sometimes, you know, sometimes he will come, you know, at 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning, you know. So he, you know, he got his teaching done at 12 o'clock at midnight. He started getting his calls from Singapore and Taiwan and all these places till 4 in the morning. And he doesn't have need to show up at 6 o'clock, you know. But he does. And the reason is that, you know, when you're doing the Guru Yoga practice, we're visualizing visualizing the merit field, you know, that, where we're down, over there, you know, you see the mushrooms kind of like clouds, you know. With all the, so that's the, you know, that's called the merit field, which is the, it's a visual imagery of all of the lineage, actually. It's not just the merit field, it's the lineage of the teachings, right? All the way from Shakyamuni Buddha down to the present day, all the teachers through whom the teachings are passed, right? Down to his, you know, His Holiness Dalai Lama, and Lama Tsongkhapa is in there, and so forth, you know. So you're visualizing all this, all our teachers, and so, you know, so that has great benefit when you're doing the Guru Yoga, right? But if your teacher is in front of you, that's just amazing, right? And to be able to do the Guru Yoga, to make the offerings and all that stuff, right? And that's the reason he shows up, you know? He doesn't need to show up. He doesn't need any more students. He doesn't need to, like, be more famous, you know, all that stuff, right? But he shows up at 6:30 in the morning because he sees that, you know, he knows that the benefit that's going to, you know, and he doesn't need any more benefit either. It's all from our, all for us, right? So he shows up because he knows the benefit we're going to get because we're able to make the, do this practice while he's present, right? So like that, you know, we have to kind of think about these, you know, so when we think, when we go over and over these topics, we see things differently, you know. Before I used to think, you know, many years ago, oh God, you know, why do I have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning? But then you kind of think about these things and you're like, wow, I'm so happy I get to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, I mean, because, you know, you get, you know, the for the little sacrifice we have to make, the end result is so it's just something totally, you know, amazing. You know, and it's all because of the kindness of the gurus. And whatever little progress we've made, each of us, right? It's because of our gurus, you know. I mean, when I was doing the when we were doing the meditation, right? I mean, we've been around countless lifetimes. We've you know, people have all these, you know, Lama Zopa says, you know, people have all these great, you know, like goals, right? You know, they want to climb Mount Everest, or they want to travel so many different places, or they, you know, do this or do that, or skydive, or go down to the depths of the ocean, whatever it is, right? And he says, well, we forget that we've done it a million times before already. It's nothing new. You know, what is new is if we're able to make progress on the path. We haven't done that yet. That hasn't happened. That's why we're here, right? And so every time we take birth, rebirth as a human being, or as a, or maybe a high, you know, higher being, you know, we are what do you call it? Breaking new ground, right? And so where we are today is because of many virtuous actions we've done in the past, and they're only because, I mean, how are we going to make progress on the path without a, we already talked about this, right? Without a guide, we cannot make progress on the path. We are here because we have made some progress on the path. So we have met guides in the past. We have met spiritual teachers in the past. So that's, you know, so we just have to continue to strive to become, to continue to be proper vessels so that we can continue to meet our teachers, right? And that's why, you know, we make those prayers. May I be, you know, may I continue to have, you know, in all my future lives, may I not be separated from my gurus, right? That's why we continue to make those prayers. So then, so yeah. So that's why, yeah, okay. So then, one of the, so then the last part is, you know, so we've talked about all these things about the teacher and relating to them and trying to have positive attitudes towards them and so forth and so on, right? So what are the benefits of, So remembering the teacher's kindness and being respectful, right? So there's two sections, how to rely on thought and how to rely on practice, right? So how to rely on thought, it again kind of has, remember when we talked about how to be a proper student, they had all the similes or, I don't know, analogies, like a sun, like a dog, like a vajra, like a earth, like the vehicle, you know, so forth and so on. So they have those, like, for that, as for how to be, you know, how to relate to a teacher in thought, you know. So, so the spiritual teachers are like doctors who free us from old age and death, right? So they're like the, you know, classic analogy is, you know, we're sick, we need help. So what do? We go to the doctor. What does the doctor do? Give us medicines, right? Which is, the doctor is the Buddhas, or the Buddhas are the gurus. Give us medicine, which are the teachings, the Dharma. And then we practice, which is we take the medicine, right? And then we get better, like that, right? So So they're the doctors who free us from old age and death, you know, the cycle of birth and rebirth that we can continuously go through. The spiritual god is like Indra, whose divine power causes the rain of nectar to fall. So Indra is in Hindu mythology or Indian mythology. It's in classical Indian mythology, he's like Zeus, you know, the head of the, you know, the chief, you know, the warrior, you know, the guy who's in leads you to battle. You know, the gods of the warrior god, I guess. So his divine power caused the rain of nectar to fall. So gods such as Indra have the power to bring rain to the fields. When this rain comes, it's like nectar that has the power to save our lives. So they give us the good, you know, the nectar of good instruction. So it's like that. So guru, like a full moon, increases one's white qualities. I mean the good quality, virtuous qualities. And like the clarifying sun, shows the way to peace. So the guru is like a mountain, unwavering to friend or enemy. You know, it's like, so if one has equanimity, right? I mean, we say, you know, may all beings have equanimity, free from attachment and aversion, right? So that's the guru embodies that, right? So he's like a mountain. He is unmoved by friend or enemy. Or unwavering toward friend or enemy. So he relates to them with the same compassion or the same kindness, right? I mean, they say that one of the qualities of a Buddha is that a Buddha always sees. I don't know. I saw this translation, but never. You know, it says he sees Buddhas see everyone as attractive. You know, what that means is that whether or not they don't see the outer qualities, right? They see every being, however disgusting, if you will, as, you know, just attractive. As you know, they see everyone as just equally beautiful. Right? They see the inner qualities. So like that, you know, maybe I told you the story of Lama Zopa, you know, there was a dead snake on the ground. Did I tell you this story? Yeah, so that's like that, you know. I mean, he was asking us to do the prayers for this snake at midnight, no less. But anyway, and so, you know, it's lying on the ground and the snake is all, it's just, I still see it in my head, you know. It's really, you know, it's a long snake and it's been run over by this car so many times, I don't know, in many cars, I guess. And it's just flattened and it was just pitiful, really. And I could barely look at it, you know. I mean, really, I just kept my eyes like half shut, you know. And there he is, bending over the snake like a foot away. And he's doing his mantras, and his prayers and, you know, looking at it and just really just, you know, I'm like, wow. You know? I mean, I can barely just come within 3 feet of the snake and keep my eyes just barely keep it open, my nose closed, you know. But, you know, that's what I mean, you know, he doesn't see, he sees only the inner quality. He sees everybody as equally beautiful, right? He doesn't have the sense of aversion that I do, you know? So, yeah. So then when you see things like that, you know, it's easy to kind of see somebody as a Buddha. You know, yeah. So go to Lama Zopa's teachings. I would encourage you. It'll be easy to see him as a Buddha. Might try your patience the first few times, but once you get past that. So teacher has a mind as undisturbed as a calm ocean. So he's like the guard, he's my guardian, like the pilot of a ship. You know, so these are the things they say as to how to relate to a teacher in thought. You know, when we are, you know, thinking about him, whether we're in front of him or whether we're not, you know, when we're having negative thoughts about him or whatever, or to bring up, you know, to meditate and bring up positive quality, you know, to think about his positive qualities. Those are the things to think about, right? You know, we meditate all the time. You know, we forget this, right? I mean, we're good at meditating. I mean, we meditate all the time. We happen to, you know, like, for example, when somebody really annoys us, we'll meditate for hours about how they annoy us, how much we can't stand them, you know, how much, what they do every day, and all the stuff. You know, we go through like hours and hours of these, you know. So if we can do that, what they're saying is, you know, just think of the other way. You know, think about your teacher and think about all his qualities and just meditate on that, right? Think, you know, just instead of thinking about somebody's negative qualities, think about somebody's positive qualities, right? And if we can do that, we can make that change. We can make that, you know, we're able to see him as a guru. I mean, seeing it as a Buddha. And then it says how to rely on practice, right? And so how to rely on... So actually, maybe I'll stop here now. And I mean, before I go to how to rely on practice. Did anybody have any... Because I've been talking for a long time. Did anybody have any questions about how to relate to a guru? Whether as a Buddha or whether or not. I kind of rushed it. I felt I rushed it a little bit, but... No? Okay. So, so how to rely on practice? You know, they say that we can relate to them in our practice through making offerings. By performing service and by acting on, you know, by following his instructions. Right? So those are three main ways we can rely on him through our practice. So one of the first one is offering, it says honor and goods, right? So goods is obvious, right? So if we, you know, when we make offerings to them, you know, monetarily or whether we provide them lunch or, you know, all those things, because if we're able to make that offering with pure motivation, right, and because there's such a vast field of merit, right, that offering has incredible result, right? I mean, that's one reason, like, for example, in Lama Zopa, accepts offerings, right? So he comes to he gives a teaching and you make an offering, right? But you see, you're like a couple of years ago when he came, right? So he came and people, actually, here and as well as in the retreat. And so, you know, people gave him offerings, but then he takes all that money, right, offer, you know, give him checks, right? Gives all the money and then he gives it to the center, back to the center, right? He doesn't keep any of it, so he gives it back to the center. Now, the question is, he could have just said, well, why don't you just write a check to the center, right? The reason he's accepting offerings from us is because he knows that the benefit to us, again, of giving the offerings to him is what, that's the whatever we call it. I don't know. That's where the benefit comes from, right? If we're able to make him offerings with pure motivation and seeing him as a guru, right, that has that amazing, you know, result. And so that's why, you know, teachers, you know, qualified teachers, you know, they accept offerings, right? Because they accept offerings because they know that the student is who's getting the benefit, right? And they're acting out of their compassion for the student, right? Because we ordinary beings have only so many ways that we can get benefit, right? I mean, we can't do the great practices, you know? We may not have the place where we can do great practices, right? We may not have the karma in this lifetime to be do great practices, right? But we can do little things. Offerings is one little thing, right? And that's why they're in this relationship with us, right? So So whatever offerings we make, they say, has to be of best quality. Whatever best quality that we can provide, right? It doesn't mean that we have to go buy like $1,000 or whatever it is, right? And give it to him, right? It means that whatever, it's from our heart, right? So whatever we, or one way to look at it, they say is, is it the quality that we would give to ourselves, right? If it's something, you know, because we have something left over, you know, let's say in the kitchen, you know, it's kind of halfway about to expire and we give it to the gurus, right? I mean, it's something that we would treasure. If somebody gave it to us, we would think it's wonderful, right? Like that, right? So we have to offer something of, because then it's not a pure motivation, right? If you're trying to get rid of it or something like that, you know, oh, it's some extra, I have an extra one, I'll give it to him, right? It's not a pure motivation anymore. So giving to your teacher is equivalent to continually make offerings to all the Buddhas. Not just one, all the Buddhas, right? Because that's the again, the field of merit. From such offerings, you acquire the accumulation of merit. From this accumulation, the supreme attainment is reached. I don't know. One time it was explained to me that, you know, if you ever wonder, you know, some people have many gurus, right? My teacher, for example, has 30 gurus. And so the question is, so he was, you know, somebody asked him, so who do you make prayers to, right? I mean, you make prayers to one guru, don't the other ones, what about the other ones? Are you neglecting them, right? So it was interesting what he said. He said that, because they're all Buddhas, right? To him, they're all Buddhas. So what he said was that, well, number one, what he actually does is that he kind of like, he has, you know, just like all of us, right? He has one main guru. And so a lot of times what he does is that when he does a practice, like a guru yoga practice, he will visualize all his gurus there, right? His merit field, right? And then they all kind of become his guru, right? They all, you know, because they're all out of emptiness, right? Those of you who've done the guru yoga practice, you know. Right? They're all out of emptiness. So they basically coalesce into his guru, and then he makes the offerings and he makes the prayers to his guru, right? So that way he's making offerings to all his gurus, right? So that's one way to do it. The other way he sometimes does it is that he kind of alternates, you know? So like he'll do a practice to his guru every day, but then for 5 minutes he'll do one, and then the next day he'll do another one, and so forth and so on like that, right? So because why are you doing it? It's not, I mean, to keep your connection with them, right? Because, you know, if you're saying that may I not be separated from my gurus in all my future lives, you have to keep that connection, right? If we don't continue to do it, we're not going to have that connection, right? We're not going to meet them in our future lives, right? So the other thing he said was that, you know, gurus are not selfish, right? Because they wouldn't be in this business if they, well, I guess there are gurus who are selfish and are in this business, but the qualified, you know, those of, you know, who have those 10 qualities we spoke about, right? They're not in this because of something for themselves, right? They're in it only because to help us, right? So they don't mind if we are making prayers to this guru, but we're not doing it to him, right? Because if we think of them as all Buddhas, right? They're all of the same Buddha nature, right? Because they say, right, that the quality of the Buddhas, right, the Buddha's mind, is the Buddha nature is of one. It's one, right? All of the Buddhas, all of us actually, the Buddha nature that we have is of the same nature, right? So, and it's the same quality that the Buddhas have. It's just they have reached fruition, right? We haven't been able to get there yet. And so the way it was explained to me is that, you know, you can think of the Buddha's mind as like the ocean, right? Because, And then there are all these rivers that come to the ocean. So all the Buddhas are these different, their mental, each of us have a different mental continuum, right? All the Buddhas have a different mental continuum. So there are all these different rivers that come to the same ocean. It's the same nature. It's the same water. It just happens to be, have a different, I don't know, you know, stream, right? So at the end, it's all the same. So whether we, you know, do our prayers to the Amazon or whether we do the prayers to the Mississippi, it really doesn't matter. We're making the prayers to all the Buddhas, right? So that's why it says here, I went into all this because it talks about, you know, that's why it says giving to your teachers equivalent to making offerings to all the Buddhas. You know, because, you know, we, if we're able to see him as the equivalent of a Buddha and all our gurus and all the Buddhas around us, right? Because he's the embodiment of all the Buddhas. So that's making offerings. And the other way we can make offerings is it's said to honor and to goods, right? So we talked about goods. Honor is basically, you know, to talk, you know, when you're talking about him to, you know, like, I don't know if you saw Venerable Thupten Children when she was talking about her gurus, you know, she went like this. Did you notice that? Right? She, you know, because she, because, you know, you'll see this of other teachers, you know, when they talk about their teacher, you know, they go like this. His Holiness does this too. You know, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, actually, he'll go like this, you know, because whenever he talks about, you know, His Holiness, or he talks about Song Rinpoche, one of his teachers, he goes like this, Rinpoche Rinpoche, you know. So that's like offering with honor, right? So whenever they think about their teachers, they hold them in such high esteem, right? They're making a prostration, essentially, every time that they're thinking of, you know. So like that, right? Out of respect, actually. Not just prostration, it's out of respect, right? And so that's making offerings. And then the next way was to perform services. So this is, you know, the, you know, when your teacher needs something, you know, we talked about this, right? To be like a vehicle, to be like the earth, right? So, you know, if they ask us to do something, if we do it with just, you know, joy, with, you know, with the best way we can, right? So if we're able to do that, then that's performing the right kind of service to them. And finally, they say the best way we can rely on our teacher in practice is to follow his instructions. That's what he or she really wants us to do, right? They're here only so that we can make progress, right? So making offerings is good, performing services is good, but if we're able to follow their instruction to do the practices, you know, to be the best person that we can be, you know, according to his instructions, that's the best way we can repay the kindness of our teachers. So that's, you know, if we can, you know, that, and it's the best part is that it's free, it's cheap, you know. It does require effort. Other than that, you know, we don't have to, you know, save up for it, and, you know, we don't have to, yeah. So that's the best way we can repay their kindness. I think that's the only last section then is left is to talk about the benefits of, which is important. I thought about doing it first, but then I decided to do it last. But anyway, the benefits of why, you know, of relating to a teacher, you know. So we'll talk about that next time. And then we will do the practice, right? The Shakyamuni Buddha practice. So if nobody has questions, so we'll dedicate. So whatever merit we've gained, may we dedicate to all our
all our spiritual growth. May we continue to foster a relationship with our teachers. May all beings be able to make that relationship. May all our teachers, may their wishes, all their aspirations be fulfilled. May all their efforts come, you know, bear fruit quickly. And may we never be separated from our teachers in all our future lives. Thank you very much.